Hi, welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is the other thing I do. My guest this week is Jamie Kastner, a documentary filmmaker whose credits include The Secret Disco Revolution, Kike Like Me, and Recession Eyes for Fun and Profit. His latest picture, The Skyjacker's Tale, digs into the story of Ishmael Labitte, a Vietnam vet convicted of multiple murders who hijacked an American Airlines flight from New York to the U.S. Virgin Islands in 1974 and made a break for Cuba. Having premiered at TIFF last year, it opens in Toronto this Friday, January 20th, at the Hot Docs Theater. Jamie went for The Producers, Mel Brooks' first and probably greatest feature film, an ingenious comedy about a low-rent Broadway producer named Max Bialystock and a delicate accountant named Leo Bloom who come up with a perfect fraud, sell hundreds of shares in a terrible play, and keep all the cash their investors will write off when it flops. But the perfect fraud requires a perfectly awful product, which is where Springtime for Hitler comes in. A genuinely cutting satire powered by the all-time great pairing of Zero Mostel and Gene Wilder as Bialystock and Bloom, and featuring some really terrific bad songs. The Producers was a left-field hit that minted Brooks as America's master of questionable taste, while the subsequent Oscar win for Best Original Screenplay demonstrated the Academy's excellent taste. If you haven't seen it, you are missing out. Although if you only know The Producers as that terrible musical with Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick, I'd argue you're missing out even more. This is someone else's movie.
I mean, I've seen it a million times. Right. I love it. I quote from it frequently. My nine-year-old child quotes from it frequently. You know, it's like basically gospel between the older members of my family and I, and so many parts of that movie have entered our language as a family or as a kind of sensibility, you know, the people with whom I have shared sensibilities, that I have the sense that half of The Producer's dialogue has entered the language at large, but it could be smaller than that. So I went back, but then I had this pang, this moment of pang, thinking, is it really that good? Does it really stand up? Because that's really one of the interesting things about movies, right? Is you have this thing that you loved at a certain point that you saw in your life, and does it stand up when you see it again? And so I watched it yet again. I mean, I own a copy of it. I watched it yet again before coming today. And yes, it does stand up. I love that movie. I love every scene in that movie. And I think it's a masterpiece. It really is. It's a classic. And I love analyzing things. I mean, coming from journalism as well. But it's one of those things. Now, I know we're going to proceed to do this for the next hour, happily.
That's what we're for.
But it's one of these things where one's initial feeling is, and maybe this is particularly true with comedy. I don't care. We're going to do it anyway. But, you know, analyzing it, you almost don't want to analyze it. It's so just perfect as it is, but let's analyze it.
Yeah, it's a fascinating thing, right? I mean, that is the line, like, looking into comedy is poking the dead frog. Like, whatever happens, the frog's already dead. You've killed it just by opening
Right, we can only diminish it, you know.
But The Producers, I went back and looked at it again as well, and it's 50 years since they shot it, and there was a period in the 90s where it felt dated, and now it doesn't feel dated anymore. It's really weird. It came in and out of something, some cultural relevance or something. I don't know. I think, and I'm wondering if it was just maybe Brooks himself going bigger and broader that made The Producers suddenly look weird and out of place. But now it's perfect.
Maybe. Yeah. It's because he is an incredible, I mean, look, I think of Mel Brooks, not to say that I love by any means everything he did, but I consider him my chief rabbi.
Okay.
I mean, you know, I had a project in development, which sadly did not, or at least has not yet come to fruition, which is a thing on Jewish humor. Mm-hmm. And my production company is actually named after a Mel Brooks line from The 2000-Year-Old Man, a botched reference, I must say, Cave 7 Productions.
Oh.
But it's from a 2000-Year-Old Man book. So, I mean, I really revere the guy, and that said, I recognize that he is a sort of shameless rehasher of his material, and there's a lot of fat in there. The Producers The producers and parts of The 2000-Year-Old Man, I guess, are my favorite things still that he's done. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's first novel syndrome, right? It's the purest expression of what it is he's going to say.
And I believe
he might not get another chance.
Yeah, exactly. And it's the thing that he had cooking up for years. I mean, he had been a writer on the Sid Caesar show,
Serious Show shows.
And I think there were actually like lean periods before, relatively speaking, before after Your Show of Shows and before The Producers happened. And I'm quite sure he had written this as a novel first. I mean, I think it's one of the few films that he wrote alone. I'm remembering this mainly from a great old Kenneth Tynan New Yorker profile of him that was done in the 60s, I think, or yeah, 60s or early 70s. But in any case, yes, exactly. First novel syndrome. He had time to work the material, and I think it was one of the only things he wrote without a kind of writer's room, mm-hmm. Doing it. Although he had some surprising and interesting people in his writer's room subsequently, including Barry Levinson on High Anxiety.
Yeah, you know, who appears? He's the guy who gets stabbed with the newspaper. It's just such a weird. I asked him about that once because I talked to him when he came through town for. The Bay, the Eco Project, the Eco Horror film
a couple years ago that nobody
remembers.
No, I don't remember it either.
And no one associates with Barry Levinson either. It's a found footage thriller about an ecological collapse that Barry Levinson directed like 3 years ago and never released theatrically, went straight to video. Isn't very good.
Isn't very good,
but
unfortunately.
We talked briefly about it. I was like, how did it even happen? And he said, Mel thought I was funny in the room and just gave him the role. And it's... And you can point out that's the guy who made Diner and Tin Men and Sphere. And he's just...
And Wag the Dog.
What a bizarre career to have. But I guess if you work with Brooks early enough, you have some kind of weird energy that he'll latch on
to. That he'll respond to,
Look at Wilder, right? No one had seen anything like that performance.
Right. Still my favorite thing that, if that's not sacrilegious to say, my favorite thing that Gene Wilder did as well.
No, it's easily mine.
Because he's so... He's contained in a way by who could act opposite Zero Mostel. I mean, who could act? It's everybody's best work in that thing. You know, where to begin? But yeah, I think that Wilder's performance is of necessity contained by all the air that Zero takes up in the room so brilliantly. And apparently he and Brooks were at complete loggerheads through the filming of that, which
Wilder.
Zero Mostel and Brooks. Yeah,
that makes sense.
Yes, you can see that they're too similar.
Yeah, it's an incredible, they're both incredible performances, both Wilder and Mostel. But Mostel is he's a bull who, he's constantly charging. Like, he's charging into every line of dialogue, into every gesture. Even the caricature on that DVD cover there is terrifying.
He is terrifying. I've seen pictures of him from who was that great New Yorker photographer? Anyway, one of the old New Yorker photographers who shot, you know, the stars of the 60s. Anyway, I've seen pictures of him starring in a production of The Rhinoceros, mm-hmm. of Ionesco's The Rhinoceros. Now, obviously, I didn't see the production before I was born, or, you know, at least going to theater. But he embodies that. You know, he is like a rhinoceros. He's revolting and terrifying and yet so nuanced. That film really sets its own tone, creates its own language, its own code. You know, it defies all sorts of rules. I don't know if you have at some point, but there's that book, terrible title, but actually a great book called When the Shooting Stops, the Cutting Begins.
Yeah, it's right over your shoulder.
There you go.
I was actually just kind of looking for it a minute ago, just thinking, oh, this is what the... This, like, there's that so, anecdote.
Right, by the Ralph editor, Rosenblum. Ralph Rosenblum, who had an incredible career in his own right, going from like the dawn of documentary with Flaherty through seven or eight Woody Allen movies, Mel Brooks, three Sidney Lumets, etc.
I think he worked with Friedkin on the night they raided Minsky's too.
That's right. That's what the whole
just everything
opening chapter is about. And of course, it's like the editor's view of the world in which, you know, everybody's an asshole and the editor saves everything. He doesn't say, sounds like an incredible curmudgeon, but a brilliant one, no doubt.
It is remarkable just how many filmmakers have had tantrums in his room, although I suppose they all must. But there's that story of Brooks just being furious that he doesn't have control.
Well, he is very, as much as he reveres Woody Allen, Rosenblum, he is dismissive of Brooks. And that is the one thing I disagreed with. I wasn't there.
Yeah.
But I mean, I thought, whatever, Ralph. You know, he kind of characterizes Brooks, obviously on this film, that was the only film they did together, understandably given the account. But he characterizes Brooks as a kind of cinematic primitive.
Yeah.
And now, while many things about that book was very educational when I read it sort of early in my filmmaking life, but I remember him saying, trying to teach Brooks in his account again, that in cinema you don't have to go A, B, C, D, you can go from A to D. That is kind of one of those fundamental and rather good lessons.
Yeah, it's grammar, basically, screen grammar.
Yeah, exactly. But whatever it was, whatever combination of forces, you know, fought their way together through this thing, I mean, it's brilliant. And I mean, I always thought, you know, before I started working in film, you know, obviously I loved film, but people would come out of movies talking about the cinematography and say, oh, wasn't the cinematography beautiful in that movie? And I always felt, you know, sure, I appreciate pretty pictures, but if you're paying attention to the cinematography, there's something wrong with the movie.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, if the narrative isn't carrying you.
Yeah.
It's generally a danger signal that, you know, ooh, pretty lens flares is never something you want to hear, except maybe in Die Hard once, that one time.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, yeah.
I mean, so that if maybe Rosenblum has a point, I've never been able to focus on the craft long enough to notice. You know, that's the highest compliment I can pay the producers right. On that point. You're just absolutely swept up in it.
Yeah. And that's the thing that hit me this time through was the mania of it. Like, even the music is having an episode. It's just extreme and heightened and fast. Right from the jump. I mean,
you
start in the middle of this chaos and it never really stops being chaotic. It just builds into a sort of a musical shape that has highs and lows within the musical. But everyone is pitched so high. And I mean, 1967 was not the most, you know, high-paced year for cinema. There was some great stuff being made, but this must have been like coming into a theater and being hit with a freight train.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't have the years. You probably have them more on the top of your head. But when you think about that golden age of independent cinema, you know, the kind of Easy Riders, Raging Bulls time would have been
right around
right around there. Starting. I mean, this is a totally different. In a way, I was struck watching it again by its outrageousness. It is its outrageousness and at the same time its innocence, because it comes from an era that was still innocent enough that you could actually still be outrageous. You know, I don't how now. I mean, some of that stuff is touching on such cultural, historical, everything taboos, every taboo imaginable.
Yeah, you kind of have to explain to people that this was maybe 22 years after the end of the war.
Yeah.
There was a generation that was missing. There were people that just still, I mean, Germany hadn't even begun to process its trauma yet. There was all this stuff going on, and there is no modern analog, right? Like, people are making movies about 9/11. It doesn't, there is no taboo anymore because everything moves so quickly.
No, and of course, you're touching on something key, I think, which is that part of the part of the horror of the Holocaust was how long it seemed to take people to acknowledge the Holocaust.
Sure, yeah.
I mean, everywhere that seemed to have been the case, and certainly, indeed, as you're saying in the movies, I believe The Pawnbroker is generally thought of as one of the first American movies, anyway, that addresses it.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
that would have been actually
64. It wasn't
not that long before this. Mm-hmm. So look at the leap, indeed. And this is for an American audience. And you know, obviously there are Well, when you see the other thing, I mean, that movie is the essence of Jewish humor to me. You know, Mel Brooks is the essence of Jewish humor. All that gags, that irrelevance, that irreverence, I should say.
Either or. Either or. The characters themselves are irrelevant before they do this, which is sort of the point.
Right, right, right.
But it is, it's the weirdest underdog story I can imagine.
But it's a perfectly crafted little story. And I think that that's part of what, of why it stands up. I mean, there's a gag a second in that thing that indeed range from, like, you know, very literate, you know, I was just sort of starting to, on rewatching it, well, okay, there's a Dostoevsky reference, there's an Ibsen reference, there's a Kafka reference, you know, of course the character Bloom is a Joyce reference, you know, he's packing it in there. It's certainly highbrow by today's standards. And at the same time, it's all this, you know, physical humor. Now I completely lost my train of thought. I like this movie. Did I mention
that? Yeah, it came up. You were talking about the irreverence and the embrace of the taboo. Last week's episode was the original Heartbreak Kid, which
Watts brought in. Yeah, yeah.
And that led to an interesting conversation about the Jewish perspective in that film, which is really weird and self-loathing and creepy and predatory almost by the time the film is
over. Well, that's what Judaism has meant to me. I don't know what... that's half the fun of being a Jew right there.
It's the predation. sorry. In the age of Trump, it's about to be less fun.
Way to kill any good time. Just mention that word.
It's fascinating, though, the way anti-Semitism has sort of rolled back right up again.
Yes.
Because it was just waiting. It was always there. It's been waiting for its shot. And it doesn't really factor into The Heartbreak Kid except for a couple of little lines. But it's
unstated. Oh, but it's the whole thing of it. The whole story hinges on it way,
but
right?
It's never made explicit. You could see the movie and not know. Like,
if you were a Gentile.
Yeah, you could miss it. You could just not get it. You could just think it's about a pushy guy.
Right.
Which it is.
Which who dumps his Jewish wife in pursuit of
Gentile
this
perfection.
Fantasy. Yeah, yeah.
But with the producers...
I have always dreamed of playing a game like this with a girl like you. Yeah. Sorry, anyway. Yeah. It's not my week.
Oh, no. People, if you missed it last week, listen, watch The Heartbreak Kid.
Oh, it's a great movie.
It really is something. But 5 years earlier, you have the producers where the very Jewishness of the characters is not only essential to the plot, but also to the humiliation. Like, the idea that, even inadvertently, two Jewish producers would make a musical about the Nazis, and that it would be a success, is this vulgar triumph that Brooks concocts for himself, and then, being Jewish himself, goes out and realizes by making the movie, which becomes a massive hit. It's an incredible leap intellectually that he could even think of it and then pull it off, and that it now stands as a classic. It's kind of amazing because he was the guy who was spitting out silly jokes that were supposed to be, you know, ephemeral. They weren't supposed to last. His stuff, and a lot of his stuff hasn't really, other than Spaceballs, which children fell in love with on cable after it was released, but it's not a good movie by any stretch of the imagination. A lot of his work has sort of just kind of fallen to the side, but the early stuff, the producers, Young Frankenstein, Blazing Saddles, they're amazingly timely and immediate and satirical, but they're also enduring in a way that I don't know that even he intended. I mean, maybe Young Frankenstein, because that is, like, that's a pitch-perfect satire of 1930s filmmaking, so it can't date.
Right.
But the other two, the producers in Blazing Saddles, are so utterly contemporary that it's terrifying.
Yeah.
And now, 50 years later, they hold up really, really well.
Yeah, they do. And no, you're making an interesting point, yet another interesting point, about, I mean, one thing that I gave some thought to as I was developing my unmade Jewish humor project, but was how long it took. On one hand, there is this cliche of all of Hollywood being Jewish, and there is no doubt a disproportionate number of creators who are in that sphere, but Jewishness itself was not directly addressed until very late. I mean, really, it's true. It's implicitly there in the producers, and it's there in every pore of the producers.
But yeah, it's never stated directly.
No, it's never stated directly, other than you. But at the same time, I mean, it's part of what's fun about it is also, you know, being a producer, producing my own films myself. Of course, you think of it often. You know, there are many. It's an endless satire of showbiz, apart from anything else. And the idea that you're going to put on armbands and go and solicit the script from a Nazi playwright in order to get what to get what you need.
Yeah.
You know, it's I haven't quite done that yet, but you know, the night is young.
I'm sure people do find themselves in that position more often than not. I mean, I was just talking about Under the Sun, the film about the North Korean propaganda industry, where clearly if you go in saying, oh, I just want to reveal your machinations, it's never going to happen.
But no.
You just go along to get what you need.
Of course. In documentary, sure, that's pretty well the definition.
Yeah.
Put on the armband. What am I saying? I haven't done it. I've done it repeatedly. Yeah, of course. Of course.
But then you do, in the producers, as far as the visual joke, of course, of Gene Wilder looking like he's going to vomit but standing still is amazing. Like, his misery, the way that he starts out sad and just gets more miserable, even yes. as he gets more manic. I mean, we could talk about the script, we could talk about the structure, but if you don't have Mustell and Wilder, and especially Wilder, because I'm in awe of that performance, because he has to be just as insane, but in a completely different, like, backwards in heels, really.
That's right.
Because he can't do what Mustell is doing,
yeah.
or it would be unbearable.
And he tends to be, I mean, generally speaking, a kind of over-the-top, rather manic performer himself, mm-hmm. in other roles. But you're exactly right. He has to go in the other direction, and it comes in quiet, yes. quiet moments. But I mean, when the intersection of the two of them, I mean, like those setup scenes, there is not a bad scene in that movie. It's all so good. And it's as you say, it starts at such a pitch and then it just grows and grows and grows. It's incredible, because how much more outrageous you think can you get than a disgusting, sleazy old producer in an old robe with that ridiculous comb over, coming on to little old ladies in his office in order to, I mean, it's so, you can hardly describe it without bathing, you know, or, you know, wanting to lawyer up in case someone charges you with something merely for recounting the plot synopsis.
Yeah.
And then, but anyway, I'm just thinking of that moment, apropos the performances, where I'm hysterical and I'm wet, yeah, and I'm in pain.
Blanket scene, I think that is my favorite thing that Wilder has ever done, because it's just, there's nothing else like it in the universe, I don't think. The fact that he is, because he's an accountant, he is measuring out what is wrong with him as he has a psychotic episode. It's right. So perfectly in character, and he found a way to do it. Yeah, no, I think
nice. That benefited from analysis. That didn't kill it.
It only struck me this time.
Yes,
like, oh my
good.
God, he's making a list. Like, he's actually telling you what's wrong with him. And the fact that Mustell, it's the only time in the film that he shows fear, because he doesn't know what to do.
Right.
It's such an amazing moment where you realize, okay, whatever else happens, and this is only the first act.
Yeah.
That these guys are matched. They're perfect. This is how a buddy dynamic works. That neither of them can fully predict what the other will do, but they need each other to live.
Right.
And yeah, they each enable the other's worst, best instincts, I guess, because as they have said for 50 years, the producers is a genius plot, and I'm sure it's been used in the real world. Certainly, that's how Uwe Boll finances his films, right?
Right.
They're guaranteed to lose money to take advantage of tax loopholes in Germany, which, as soon as the loopholes closed, he stopped working because he knew he couldn't do it any other way. It's amazing that Mel Brooks has given us a blueprint for how to work the system.
Yeah, exactly.
And every time you see a plague flop or a movie come out with such a terrible idea behind it, I kind of wonder, was this, as I also want to believe as a film critic that no one sets out to make a bad movie, because that would make my life horrible if I didn't believe that.
Right.
But then I just saw Underworld 5 last week, and well,
so much for that theory.
I don't know that anybody cared. Like, Kate Beckinsale must have had her heart broken. She just worked with Stillman on Love and Friendship, and now she's doing this again.
Right.
But There'll be another one. They make money. They break even. They generate funds.
Right.
To make more bad movies.
And somebody, somebody keeps getting rich. Somebody keeps getting rich off them one way or another. It is a strange business. It is a very strange business. I've been joined in my little production company in the last year by my wife, who I somehow lured away from corporate law with promise of, the riches and glamour and glory of documentary filmmaking.
Sure. Make your own hours, yeah. All of them.
And it's interesting to kind of see someone else learning the business afresh and realize, like watching a movie with someone who's seeing it for the first time, you're seeing all the bizarreness of it, which much of which is captured in that. In addition to the accounting aspect of it, all of those little touches and flourishes, it's full of things that you catch on repeated viewing, little touches like, it opens with a scene with him and the little old lady and they're playing dirty games, dirty role playing games. And he's the Contessa and he's the Contessa and the chauffeur. And in the game, his name is Rodolfo. And then, half an hour later when they actually make all the money and they have a chauffeur, thank you, Rodolfo. Yeah. I'm sure I didn't notice the first 9 times I saw it.
Yeah.
The stuff like when Dick, also every little part, not only the stars, but every person in that movie, no matter how long they're on screen for, feels like a brilliant little character turn, a perfect casting. The lady who's the concierge right. In the Nazi playwright's building in Kenneth Mars, Franz Liebkind. The name Franz Liebkind building. She just, they make a meal out of it in what feels like a vaudevillian style, which ought not to work in film because, in fact, it's too stagey. It's too slow. But these are such a bunch of talented pros, and the thing they're riding on is so perfectly crafted that they can do it.
Yeah.
Boyds. Filthy, dirty, disgusting Boyds. Boyds used to be able to sit out on the stoop like a person. No more. No, sir. Boyds. Thank you, madam. I'm not a madam. I'm the concierge.
Yeah, it is. I was trying to figure out if there was an analog to any of it. Maybe laughing with the door bits comes close,
right.
But those weren't funny.
Right,
they didn't
contribute
to a larger thing. They were just single little bits that maybe would get a laugh and maybe wouldn't, or, Artie Johnson's talking in a funny voice. He can do so much more than that, but this is what network wants. Brooks is working without a net. Like, he's just making the movie he wants to make, and he wants Dick Shawn to do that thing. He wants Kenneth Morris to do that thing and then do more of it and do it 10 times bigger.
Yeah. And imagine the pitch meeting when you're trying to sell this.
Yeah.
And then this happens and this happens. I suppose you see the roots of it in his own work. I was going to say you see the roots of it in his work after, but even I realize that cannot be. But he is a famous recycler. And it's certainly in the sensibilities of your show of shows. I don't know if you've ever seen, there were interviews, the Writers Guild, this has already got to be 20 plus years ago now. I remember it was on PBS. There was like the Caesars Writers panel. They brought most of them together, including Brooks, Reiner, Mel Tolkien, Larry Gelbart. And
I want to say I've seen clips of it at least in something.
It was wonderful. It was great. And I remember the original airing of it, having given much thought to the cost of using clips in things. In the original airing, it had all the clips as well. Whereas when you bought the VHS, it did not. But anyway, they're all talking. And this is Neil and Danny Simon. They are all talking, these great titans of comedy writing. And in that room, you got the sense that Mel Brooks was still king of the clowns,
Yeah.
And they're still quoting back Mel Tolkien, who had been the father of Michael Tolkien, right, of the player, and and who also dated my great aunt in Montreal, I'd like to point out.
Okay.
There are a few personal, there is one other small, tiny, peripheral family reference in the producer. I was going to say, Mel Tolkien in that thing remembers Brooks coming into work carrying a bagel and the Wall Street Journal and saying he was disguised as a rich Jew. He sings back to him some song he spontaneously made up in the office, which was something like, "Soak some rags and throw them in the shul, the anti-Semitic polka."
So this is always willing to go there.
Brooks was there. I mean, you see bits of like that kind of double talk, I think it was called, on the Sid Caesar show, you know, right. the fake French fake, yeah. He in the bit part that Brooks plays when he's playing the Prussian auditioning for Hitler in the producers, he's doing it in a kind of, you know, it's half double talk. There, even some of the, there's a famous bit in that Sid Caesar show where he plays, I think it's called The General, and it's a guy who has his valet spit shining every button on his coat and fixing him up, and then the punchline of the skit is that the kind of camera pulls back and it turns out he's a doorman, and so I noticed again the little touches, like when Franz Liebkind arrives, the writer arrives at the premiere of the producers of Springtime for Hitler within the producers. There's a kind of doorman opening the car, and he fixes him up. He does a kind of Nazi twist on it, and he has the guy getting out of the car, fixing up the coat, making him stand up, spit shining his things. But you know, there are little touches in that world that they all came from, or I mean, antecedents in that Caesar world.
Sure, and he would. I mean, who can blame the guy for harvesting his best bits and making sure he had his name on them this time?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that's right. It also came out of the 2,000-year-old man. I mean, that twist on history. And I feel as though I'd have to go back and listen to all 12 CDs to find it. Yeah, like I did, which
you
is how
said
I
as well.
I found out too late that I had misnamed my company or mistaken the reference I was going for. But anyway, I feel as though some of that other stuff about Hitler being a great, you know, the 2,000-year-old yes. man, Hitler being a great basketball. He says in this one, he was a great dancer. Yes. He was, you know, people don't know that. Oh my God! Anyway, sorry.
Yeah, apparently, that's how he pitched it to someone in an interview somewhere. At least the IMDb claims this, that there's an interview with him floating around somewhere where he said, "Oh, his next movie is going to be called Springtime for Hitler," which was the original title.
Yes.
And it's going to have it's the standard line from the film. It's a joyful, gleeful romp through Baptist Garden with Adolf and Eva. But and he said, "Well, you know, Hitler was a tremendous dancer. People don't know that." He was just burping up lines. But I don't know, and I'd love to find out if he had that line written or if he came up with it and then decided, "Oh, that's good. I should keep that."
Right.
Because
right.
that clearly he spit out more stuff than he kept.
Right, right, right.
And it's just so fascinating to watch this thing evolve. I mean, even the title, I'm sure you know this, the Peter Sellers story, supposedly, again, this is the internet telling me things instead of books that I can actually point to. supposedly, MGM, United Artists, wasn't going to release the film at all. They saw it and were horrified when it was called Springtime for Hitler.
Right.
And it made its way, a print of it made its way to Peter Sellers, who was just amusing himself during down days on I Love You, Alice B. Toklas. Watched the film, loved it, and insisted it be released. And the only concession was ultimately, because Joseph E. Levine was so horrified by the result, the only concession was that it couldn't have Hitler's title named anywhere on the marquee. So they called it The Producers, which is actually better. I mean, as much as I love the hideous absurdity of Springtime for Hitler, it only works if you immediately follow with, it's a musical, it's a Broadway show, a joyful romp with Adolf and Eva. If you just put that up on the marquee, people think it's a Sorrow in the Pity. Like, they'll think it's a documentary.
Right. Right, I hadn't thought about that. Yes, I was aware that he was forced to change the name of The Producers. I didn't know about that Peter Sellers thing. That's wild. Yeah. Well, there's a kindred spirit.
Yeah. I hope it's true.
I mean, yeah, I like
no
it.
No idea, but it sounds like it should be true.
Yeah, really. And who's... You can see why I think his time was being better spent watching The Producers, having, you know, seen Alice B. Toklas at some point. We're not talking about the
60s today. Weren't for everyone.
Yeah, exactly. Also, speaking of which, yet another thing that he lampoons, that Brooks lampoons in The Producers, among the many, many things, is the 60s.
Yeah.
You know, he finds time with that LSD. All of those set pieces are just so perfectly conceived, and they all just fit into place perfectly. The little dialogue, you know, when the director, right, the worst director, Roger Debris, discovers after they're already outrageous. I mean, that again is one of the, you cannot discuss this even in passing without talking about another perfect little bit, but the Hitler casting session.
Yes.
Right? Such a funny parody of showbiz and the types, and you get it, you know, in very short strokes. The tenor, yes. You know, and the other guy who doesn't even start singing is some actor with a kind of hilariously like bulldog, like drunk face, ruddy, sweaty. He just moves his maw around a little bit and they call next. You just get the types in shorthand so well. But anyway, yeah. So when they get to Dick Shawn, LSD, Lorenzo Sandubois, as the Hitler who almost got away, right? And he has stupid gags like the Warhol reference. He's wearing a can of Campbell's soup as a necklace. And the like 60s backing chick band who are playing instruments that, if you look at it too closely, do not reflect the soundtrack at all.
I don't know that they have strings.
They don't have strings. You hear no saxophone in Love Power. And I think Love Power may have been the one song he didn't write, I think. Like someone else wrote that. But anyway, whatever.
Contracted out within
the He wasn't. But... You know, these stupid, hilarious little touches of, I was just going to say, like, even the little bits of dialogue when Roger Debris is getting him to audition. What do you do, you know, what do you do best? Or what have you been in? Or what have you done? Oh, about 6 months, man. Well, what do you do best? Oh, I can't tell you, man. That's what they put me inside for. Yeah. I mean, these stupid little bits that are hilarious and they work. And there's like, they're in a funny way. So much of Brooks's lesser works feel over the top and fat and rehashed and gratuitous. And it's hard to understand exactly why all this wonderfully gratuitous material, wonderfully and equally gratuitous material looked at in isolation works so perfectly in this film.
Well, I wonder if it isn't that with his first movies, even Young Frankenstein, which is following a Frankenstein storyline that has the spine there... But with the producers and with Blazing Saddles especially, it feels like he's not parodying a specific thing.
Right.
And like, the producers isn't a parody. It's a comedy. It just happens to have a musical parody in the middle of it.
Right.
But
which is, parenthetically.
Which is magnificent.
Hilarious. Yeah. And, you know, what who is that director you'll know? No, Busby Berkeley, the high shots, the dancing girls. I mean, and so outrageous, still so outrageous.
Yep.
I mean, it is still outrageous. The Nazis, the swastika is a symbol. Like, let's give it some credit as a brand. It has not lost an ounce of its offense value. I mean, sure. Right? It's as we're
fresh as ever, yeah.
Unfortunately, talking about these the perennial re-rising again of anti-Semitism and assholes spray painting swastikas around. There is something of the that is in a kind of Lenny Bruceian maybe sense empowering, right? About taking that symbol and turning it into the centerpiece of a high shot of a bunch of chorus girls in the middle of. Of course, there's something empowering about it. That's the whole point,
right?
You know, it's.
But there's a genius required to know you can pull it off, to even think of it in the first place, and then play it out it's fantastic, and to know that the audience will get it, or at least trust that they will. That's what I'm thinking about some of the other stuff too, like the '60s dialogue, the references, having someone come out and wearing a can of Campbell's soup. It would be dumb if that's all it was, but something about Sean's performance lets you know that he's a poser. Like, that's it. That he's faking it.
Yeah.
And
the
60s thing is just, it's his hook. If it was, like, now he'd be a hipster with artisanal barbecue or something. Like,
yeah, actually, the same outfit could work.
It could, right? Just a different, different facial hair.
Yeah, it would have to be a more local soup.
But, and a Van Dyke.
Exactly. Yeah.
But the film is smart enough to allow for the space that everyone is playing an angle, and even the idiots are trying to do something. They're trying to put something over on somebody else.
Yes.
Franz Liebkin is trying to repackage the Holocaust and Nazis and Hitler himself as, you know, misunderstood. Had some good ideas, dressed really well, danced.
I mean, and look at it. It's actually unwittingly, perhaps, you know, a parody of Holocaust denial.
In a weird way.
When you express it like that, that's what it makes me think of.
Well, certainly in 1967, Holocaust denial was still pretty much a thing for a lot of people. And there was no, like, Showa was still almost 20 years away. There was no confrontation. You could be operating in a void. You could be shouted down. You could have one book that no one else had read because there was no other. People don't understand how alone everybody was right up until about 1998.
Yeah.
Yeah, this movie would have been, I can't imagine what, again, I keep saying I can't imagine because I can't imagine how my family would have responded. I read the reviews at the time and some people were thrilled and some people were horrified and other people literally could not understand how to approach it. And it's fascinating. Just this amazing art piece that now there is no analog. I don't know what the present day version of this is.
No, there isn't. It is totally sui generis. Absolutely. And apparently one thing that's always given me some comfort is that it bombed in Germany.
Yes. Well, it couldn't be released there for a while, right? Like it had to be brought in as because the swastikas themselves were taboo. They couldn't screen it because it was contraband.
How exponentially ironic, really. It's
it had to be brought in as a festival of Jewish art or something. That's how
it made
it in. Oh,
is that right? Is that right? I've forgotten that detail. If I knew it, oh.
Well,
but I gather it didn't do very well, even. But that is.
I can't imagine anyone would take well.
Even now, I mean, there were, as I discovered researching this other project a few years ago. I mean, there have been attempts. I mean, listen, I think that. Whatever official or genuine sorrow or remorse or reparations are paid, good, you know.
Yeah, sure.
And I was going to say if it remains a touchy subject, I mean, I have tried. I've made a joke that I try to fit Hitler into every film that I do. I mean, the joke's, of course, that I don't try, but he seems to find his way in there. I did a film on disco, and there was indeed a kind of revisionist historian who had a theory that the roots of disco were in the swing kids listening to jazz on records under the Nazis. It's a theory, like another. Anyway,
sure.
So he...
I don't know that I agree. But okay.
Well, you're not alone. but anyway, so to illustrate, there was kind of a comic, the stock was a comic approach to these revisionist historical approaches to disco, in which one simply wanted to make the most of illustrating the theories and let the audience decide. And so I put Hitler in, you know, I got some stock footage of Hitler because, you know, it seems like such an insane, contrasting bunch of ideas, disco and Hitler. I would have been, you know, feels like an outtake from the producers, in fact. But when I sold that film to Germany, they made a point of saying they wanted that, but it had to be cut for length anyway. Yeah. But they, yeah.
Would you mind focusing on Hitler?
Yeah, take Hitler out, please.
That's interesting.
And still touchy over there, and appropriately so.
I think, yeah.
Yeah.
And also, talking about moving forward in time now, what everything becomes kitsch, everything becomes respectable. And the producers became a Broadway smash. Like, the producers became a massive, proper musical built around Springtime for Hitler, which I never did get to see on stage.
Me neither, yeah.
I did see the movie.
Terrible.
It was abominable.
Oh, it's terrible, that other movie. It's a shame. I mean, I was happy for Mel Brooks.
Sure.
Mel Brooks' success. And he must realize, of course he realizes by this point that this is, you know, those early things were his gold. He then tried, I gather, unsuccessfully to do this the same with Young Frankenstein, right?
Yeah.
Came and went.
Yeah.
Yes. But when you see, when you see the old movie, though, it is both a lot infinitely better, infinitely more fun, more cool, more edgy, more uncomfortable making. I mean,
it's alive.
Oh,
is the word I would use.
Yeah,
like, it actually is a thing that is happening in front of you, even though it's footage projected on a screen. It happens in front of you because it's electric. It's got something to it.
But it's interesting what you're the point of it becoming a huge hit to another generation, because at the same time, looking at this looking at the old movie now through kind of contemporary eyes, you think, oh my God, that would never get past that would never, I mean, this, he, what group doesn't he offend? Right. You know, there is the little old lady, would be marching in the street. Obviously it's full of, oh, it's full of gay stereotypes.
Talk about that. Una,
exactly. It's misogyny. It's sexist, misogyny.
Although,
you know,
again, it packages it so smartly in that it is clearly Max Bialystok's misogyny. It's not the film's. It kind of is, ultimately, because she's dressed that way for the 60s and everything else. But the idea that he can have a speech about how I bought myself a toy, I just want a toy, and it's a woman.
A very good little sequence of he listening to Ralph Rosenblum's advice of cutting from A to D, by the way, right?
He's a surprise, yeah.
He's lying, cuddling his dollar bills. Boys, I worked so hard for you. I want to get myself a toy. Cut to the pan up her long Swedish legs. Yes, I mean, you could never do that today.
Right. And in fact, in order to make it work on stage, they had to completely sell it out and give Una agency, which is fine, but it still doesn't work. Like,
no.
It fights the material.
No, Una is hilarious and perfect as she is in that old movie. It's that joke. She is that joke. The good dog pute, and then also the her reacting to the suggestion, where, through the language barrier when we go to he says get car, you know, she says we go to motel. No, not we. Me and Bloom. You and Bloom go to motel. And that, I mean, all of that. It's so juvenile and ridiculous. And of course, exponentially insensitive, but there's a kind of like, I was intrigued by how even in the watered down versions, any version of that, and the, you know, the gay jokes and all the rest of it, Roger Debris and Carmen Gia, how that flew at all, I don't know. In this day and age, maybe Mel Brooks, people realize Mel Brooks has gone so far with everything in his day that there's a kind of equal opportunity offense in the name of over-the-top comedy. But somehow, I mean, it doesn't seem like he's in a different class from, say, like a Don Rickles or something like that, which does feel kind of dirty to me. I mean, they're
dirty and hacky.
Yeah, like,
It's predictably, I mean, I think exponentially insensitive is a great way to put it. It's his defense at the time was that it rises below vulgarity, which is a magnificent argument to make in the moment. He simply went for it. And I think there is a glee, there is a joy that somehow translates of the taboo breaking and the offense and the sheer volume of it. That it's like a torrent cascading over you in a theater.
Censors are left speechless.
Yeah.
You know?
What could you object to? What can't you object to? And at that point, it's all there. Like, you can't just, you know, Blazing Saddles now, I think, is the one thing you couldn't remake because of the N-word. It's just, even with Richard Pryor writing it and Cleavon Little starring in it, it hurts now to watch that film. And to see actors that I have seen in many, many other things just throwing that word around. I get it. It was a gig. There is a larger point to it, but you couldn't do it now. You simply couldn't do it. And you shouldn't do it because it's incredibly insensitive now because we're past that.
Well,
hopefully.
I mean, I think that he was still... No, I mean, this is not about Blazing Saddles. I don't like Blazing Saddles nearly as much as the producers, but it does have its greatness. And I watched that again recently. You know, needless to say, I've brainwashed my child into having. I believe that's the only point of having children.
You
brainwash them into having sharing all your tastes. And,
that's called living your best life. That's fine.
Good. that made it sound more honorable. Thank you for that. So my kid loves Mel Brooks now. He's more of a young Frankenstein man at 9, but I figure he'll grow out of that. No, I love a young Frankenstein too, but
I can see that one having a lot of kid appeal though.
Yeah.
It's got a monster. It's got soup.
Exactly. And he repeats, well, the way also when you're a kid, you just repeat the things the grown-ups are saying and they find funny and you laugh because they laugh and it's funny how humor works and gets passed down, right? I remember well laughing at the things my family was laughing at. I didn't understand what the hell it was, but it was just, it didn't mean it didn't feel genuinely funny to me.
Yeah.
So in any case, I'm passing on this abuse. And we watched Blazing Saddles recently. And yes, there was, I had to clearly explain to him this word was never, the N-word was never acceptable in any context. And actually, I don't believe the Lenny Bruce thing I like the idea of it, but I don't believe it's true that by reclaiming these words, it robs them of their power,
right.
Which was part of my own statement at the time in calling a film Kike Like Me,
right.
Because for some reason...
But yeah. For a Jewish filmmaker to reclaim Kike, that's one thing. For a non-black person to try to reclaim the N-word, that's...
Well, that is the point about it being thing, right? Impossible to reclaim it and rob it of its power, because no matter how much you say it amongst yourselves, when some redneck says it in a disparaging way, it has all the power it ever had,
exactly.
I think, in the case of any of these words. So anyway, I told the kid that the N-word was not funny, it was not acceptable. Having made that clear to him, I could appreciate the way in which Brooks was satirizing rednecks.
Sure.
You know, that was the point of it. Yes, they're saying it, but look at those characters. They're murderous animals.
Yeah.
You know,
the line,
they're a posse.
Salt of the earth. You know, morons. It's very clear who's using the word and why.
Right, right.
But it's still, you couldn't
it's
do
horrible
it
to hear
you
it.
You simply
it's,
couldn't
it's
do
horrible
it
to hear that. No, I agree with you. I agree with you about that.
But with the producers, I think it's because Bialystok and Blum are never fully identified by the movie as Jewish. It's assumed
right.
that everyone knows.
Right.
But they're the ones with the money, so everyone pretends to respect them, including the Germans, to get their thing done. And by creating this sort of chain of need and want and making everyone feed everyone else, it's sort of okay that it never comes up explicitly, because it can't.
Right.
And
right,
then in the
right,
end,
right.
they're prisoners and the status is the same as everyone else's anyway,
right,
and
right.
they're still putting on a thing.
And they're still in showbiz. So that's how you know they're Jewish.
Yeah, yeah, right? But that's the punchline, is that the plan is so solid that they'll do it again, because they finally own this caricature, the stereotype of conniving, swindling Jews. And it's really fascinating to see the movie kind of come out that way and going, yeah, well, they're good at it. That's why. And it's Brooks' own triumph, right? Like, I pulled this off. I made this movie. It works.
Yeah.
And I think without the confidence that he provides, none of it would have connected, because you'd have one actor who didn't know what to do.
Right.
And just that lack of certainty would kill the scene.
Right.
I mean,
right.
we've all seen movies where the director clearly didn't work with the actors enough
right.
to convey what he wanted.
Right.
And that's the thing that amazes me about the producers, is that one man made this.
Yeah.
There is no question, no doubt in my mind, that he shaped and engineered everything.
Right.
And it didn't kill him. He made more stuff.
Yeah, clear.
If this was the only thing he'd ever done, it would still be a masterpiece.
Exactly. Yeah, he could have retired. Yeah.
It's something.
It is amazing. I was watching it again, and just apropos all those perfectly drawn little bit parts. Again, like scene after scene, and was it Bill Hickey who he had playing the drunk in the bar? Perfect casting,
right.
perfect face. And I mean, he was one of the better known players, actually. I don't know, or at least now I know who Bill Hickey was, but I don't know the names of most of those other people.
Right.
But boy, were they good! Like the concierge woman, or the just those faces of the Hitlers in the audition. It reminded me, actually, he even gives the hot dog man a little bit, you know, I'm not your good man, I happen to own this establishment.
That's right.
It reminds me, in a way, of something that I always appreciated, actually, about Kubrick movies, and particularly the early ones like The Killing. Mm-hmm. And he kind of peoples those films with a really gnarly little sideshow of bit parts, like the hotel clerks. Or the tellers at the racetrack.
But you're right. There is a sense of, I mean, maybe it's just a New York thing where you expect more activity and
right.
there needs to be a life to everything.
Yeah.
But yeah, the producers has the same function, where when they're running around Central Park in that fountain, there are people looking at them.
Right.
And wondering what the hell that is.
Right, right.
And it's probably just because they weren't extras and they blundered into the shot and it works. But even if they were, it makes sense. Everything that happens in the film builds that world that you're in, where everyone has another thing to do and they're always in the middle of something, and the
right.
hustle never stops.
Right, right, right.
It's, yeah, it's...
Yeah, that's a nice way of putting it. Yeah,
it's
there's
alive.
This kind of cycle of hustle. Cycles within cycles.
Yeah.
It is alive. And I think, again, watching it again, it confirms my sense, and I can't argue... Well, we've argued it shot for
Feel
shot,
free.
But I mean... It's great filmmaking. I don't care what Ralph Rosenblum thought, or maybe he was part of bringing it out. No doubt.
Yeah.
But it in its own way But it's funny the way that comic filmmakers, that's what I was thinking of when the Kubrick thought occurred, it was like, comic filmmakers don't seem to get the same cred or respect in the sort of cinema.
Sure.
You know, in the annals of cinema.
Like Billy Wilder and nobody else.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And
that's just because The Apartment is sad.
And The Apartment is not, at least in terms of what stands up, I wouldn't say The Apartment, I know that's looked at as a masterpiece, but it's... I think that's one that was kind of a masterpiece in its day because it was heralded for its modernity, you know, that it was talking about relationships in a new way. Well, we're way beyond that in talking about relationships, so that one actually feels dated, whereas Some Like It Hot I could watch over and over and over again.
Or Sunset Boulevard.
Or
Sabrina even. Yeah. I really like The Apartment, but I do feel it is kind of a museum piece now.
Yeah, yeah. The Fortune Cookie. I mean, there are a number of... Oh boy, I want to come back and talk it up.
We'll make it work.
Yeah.
But that does bring us to the natural endpoint of this conversation, which is the final question, which is, you know, is there anything of the producers that's worked its way besides Hitler into your work or your creative DNA? Have you found a way to use it, or do you even try to use it?
Oh, I forgot before I answer this
sure.
very good question. I have a much more trivial point to make, which is a small...
Is it the family? The other
it's
family
the family thing.
I kind of want to know about
the,
that.
The so, family yeah, thing is that I had I had an uncle, my late uncle Peter, who was sort of a movie star for a minute in the 60s. He starred in a kind of classic Canadian film called Nobody Wave Goodbye, then was in Francis Coppola's, one of his first films, I think his first non-B movie called You're a Big Boy Now. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so but in any case, there is a poster of a play. I appreciate the way the spirit of Mel Brooks' spirit and what he wanted to do with that movie infused every last detail from the performances to the costume to the music, as you say, to even the decor. And I can personally appreciate this because in Max Bialystock's original office in Act One, mm-hmm. he has posters which I assume are all Broadway flops on the wall because one of them, an uncle of mine, starred in, and it closed in 4 days, and it was called The Playroom, and it was him and Karen Black, who became his girlfriend for a while, were in this play. So there is a Playroom poster.
So those posters are real.
Yeah, let's say I haven't researched the rest, but I know the Playroom was real.
Well, certainly if one is, they must all.
Exactly.
It's cheap.
And that was part of the gag then, that they were flops too, that he's got the producer's office lined with flop posters.
Talk about world building.
So I feel that, I mean, as I say, just, it's funny that we're talking about this film. As I say, it's the answer that comes naturally to my lips when people ask me, what's your favorite movie? It's The Producers. But it is funny in a way that we're talking about this in light of, or on the occasion of, a film of mine being released, which is so dramatically different, you know, a kind of documentary thriller about a fugitive and airplane hijacker.
Sure.
I would say that... I feel a great kinship with that, with Brooks's mania, with his irreverence and humor and absolute lack of taboos. And I mean, look, I named my production company after a Brooks bit. I did a film called Kike Like Me, which was a highly irreverent investigation of anti-Semitism and identity, and the title and the rest of it, I think, is informed by some of that spirit, not necessarily consciously, but since you ask, you know. And I think that I think that some of that energy will bring that feeling that nothing is taboo, that you can find the humor and the contrast and the hypocrisy and all sorts of stuff in any world. I mean, be it disco, be it the recession, be it, you know, and that I suppose I do like to make, as a documentary maker primarily, although I'm working on a fiction now, you know, I try not to be a boring, earnest documentary maker. I try to make films that are entertaining first and foremost. And if people think as a result of that, then I hope people think, but it would be kind of happen organically. It's not right. something that I'm sitting them down and spoon feed and force feeding them something that I consider really important. You know, I think that here we've had a fairly, you know, a conversation that's touched on a lot of fairly serious historical philosophical things, and Brooks has led us to this with one of the most ridiculous movies ever made.
Yeah, it takes a certain kind of genius, I think, to make a movie that is as enduring and as weirdly relevant. It's prismatic. Every time you turn it, you see something new.
Yeah,
and sometimes it's a swastika, sometimes it's a cardboard belt. Like, it's anything it wants to be, which I think is so fantastic.
I mean, those. How often do I find myself thinking and laughing and quoting those lines? You know, one morning Gregor Samsa woke. They're looking for the worst script ever written. Yeah. One morning Gregor Samsa woke to find he turned into a giant cockroach. Nah, too good. Yeah. or like, wait, what did I do right? Where did I go right?
Where did I go right? Where did I go right is something. And that's our Hitler, which is probably my favorite line. Just because of the glee. And the perversity and the fact that now, of course, on rewatch, you know they're going to be punished for it. Like, it's a film about hubris, only it really, really isn't. Because every bad deed is rewarded.
That's
every
right.
mistake pays off.
It's tricky to know what the lesson of the producers is.
Yeah. I think the lesson of the producers is B. Mel Brooks.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly.
We'll all get there someday.
Here's hoping.
My thanks to Jamie Kastner, whose new documentary, The Skyjacker's Tale, opens at the Hot Docs Theater in Toronto this Friday, January 20th. It's a really interesting story and one that has some surprising parallels with present-day America. You should definitely check it out. You can find Jamie on Twitter at Jamie M. Kastner, all one word, M as in Michael, and keep tabs on his movie at Skyjacker's Tale, all one word, no M in it. And you can find the producers in an excellent Blu-ray combo edition from Shout Factory. It's also available on iTunes and Google Play. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at SomeoneElsesMovie.com. If you want to leave a review on iTunes, that would be very kind of you. Thanks for listening.